Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Barry Lenehan is in London to hear the details of the Grenfell Fire Inquiry Report, which is being published as we speak. But I just see a line coming in as it is launched, and it is stark. 72 deaths in the UK Grenfell Fire were all avoidable, according to the inquiry chairman. And we'll hear from Barry a little bit later on. Now, though, how different is everyday life in the north of this country compared to the Republic? Are houses cheaper? Is the cost of living as high? And do paramilitaries still have influence? Well, these are some of the issues up for discussion in a brand new radio and podcast series called Our Lives in the North. It's made by RTE reporter Una Kelly, who's here now. Good morning, Una.
Morning, Claire.
Good to see you. So what's the idea behind the series?
So basically, Claire, I think this is about looking beyond the flags and the politics that we normally discuss, and essentially listeners getting a tour of how ordinary people in the North are living their lives right now. It does draw some comparisons with the South, but the similarities and differences that you hear about are maybe in ways that you won't always expect. So each episode has a theme like health, education, housing, cost of living. And I think it kind of addresses the fact that there are, in my opinion, some gaps of knowledge, maybe, or maybe some assumptions or myths that people in the South might have about life in the North. And I think that given the fact that there is a live discussion about the future of this island, there's really no harm in us all knowing each other a wee bit better.
Yep, it's about filling in the gaps. And the first episode out today does look at health and the role of the NHS, because we all look to this one, don't we, when we're making comparisons?
Absolutely. I think this is really interesting for a couple of reasons. First of all, there is this real emotional attachment to the NHS that people have. I think it's a real core part of British identity, of UK identity. It was this great post-war project of universal healthcare. British politicians used to refer to it as the envy of the world. And secondly, there is this idea that people have in the South about the NHS, I think generally is maybe about 30 years out of date. The HSE, of course, has its problems, but the NHS in the North at this stage is regarded by most experts as broken. The last Health Minister, Robin Swan, said earlier this year it was near breakdown and every part of it is in profound distress. So if we looked at emergency departments, for example, the Royal College of Emergency Medicine says more people died in association with ED delays in 2022 than died during the worst year of the Troubles.
That's so extraordinary.
Yeah, and there are, of course, similar problems across health services across the UK and in the Republic, but it's really struggling in the North. So there is the target that no one should be waiting more than 12 hours in an ED. 15 years ago, the average was 230 people per month waiting 12 hours. It's now 9,500. So that's a 41-fold increase in just 15 years. Mm-hmm. So I spent a morning on shift with Dr. Garth Hampton at Daisy Hill Hospital in Newry. He told me that all EDs in the North are at capacity almost every day, if not at 150 or 200% capacity. So he gave me a bit of a tour around Daisy Hill.
The likes of this gentleman, thankfully, he's in a cubicle, being looked after, but he's in a proper hospital bed. And some of our patients in the winter were here 4 days, 5 days, in inappropriate places, stuck with all the lights on, not getting sleep, not getting the care they needed in the place they needed. So it's really tough.
Stuck in these cubicles in A&E for 4 days?
And the corridor. We can see it. It's just down here. We're now in an area which is a corridor which leads from the emergency department down towards the front foyer. And we really took that over during winter because we have two corridors. This is the less used one. And we put beds and chairs in it so we could continue to look after new patients in the emergency department. And you can see it's really brightly lit. It's really tightly compacted and there's not much privacy. And we would have had 10, 12 patients in this area. And patients would have been touching toe to head, male and female mixed, young and old mixed, a mixture of conditions.
And is that common now?
It's common in all emergency departments. This morning, we have over 300 people across Northern Ireland waiting in areas like this, waiting for a bed on a ward. We said we would never go past these doors. We would never do this, we would never do that. But we always have to keep the front door open. We have to keep our emergency department working. So at times of severe pressure, yeah, we went past these doors. We actually, at one stage in the winter, had to close the coffee shop because we had stretched as far as the coffee shop with patients.
And all of that makes emergency departments a difficult place to be.
And you're constantly making decisions about who, with a very limited resource, who gets in, who gets treatment. So it's physically demanding to, and mentally demanding to make those decisions, but it's also quite traumatic because you're going, well, no, I know your mum's probably got a broken hip. She's going to have to wait. Sorry.
Yeah, you see, I think you're right. That's Dr. Gareth Hampton. Una, we do have an idealised vision and impression here of the NHS. The waiting list for hospital appointments, how do they compare to the south?
So waiting lists in the north are twice as long for hospital appointments. And then when you look at people here waiting more than 12 months to be seen, that's four times as long. It's not uncommon at all for people to be told that they might have to wait 5 to 8 years to see a consultant. And waiting lists in the north are also the worst in the UK. Patients are waiting for up to 500,000 hospital appointments at this stage. And for context, the population of the north is 1.9 million people. I was speaking to a man called Nicky from County Down. He's one of those people on a waiting list. He was in severe pain with a shoulder issue and was told it would be 5 to 6 years before he'd see a consultant. Here he describes how bad his situation was.
The only way I could describe it to people is the pain that I am and really was. If I had had a pet, a dog, I would never let a dog suffer this. I would have got the dog put to sleep. That's the way I had a very low ebb at one stage and I have no quality of life. No quality of life, showering, dressing, everything. Even to lift a cup out of the cupboard. I explained this all to my GP. It is excruciating and again, just right out of script.
What happened to Nicky?
So that was Nicky there. He ended up paying to see a private consultant, which is what you're hearing more of. The NHS is, of course, actually not free. It's funded by taxation. People pay for that already. You hear of more and more people now paying privately to see consultants. And because of all these issues and the pressurised conditions, every doctor I spoke to while I was making this episode told me that either they have a colleague who has moved to work in the south or that they themselves are thinking about it. Karen Humphreys is one of them. She left the NHS in 2018. She's a consultant psychiatrist now in Cavan Monaghan.
The HSE, whilst it's limited, you have the private, you have the public. My patients are all public. All the services I provide are public. But you feel that you have the flexibility to make the best use of the resource you have.
You describe your work as a vocation. Money wasn't a deciding or motivating factor in choosing to leave the NHS and come work in the HSE. But can you give me a sense of what the difference is? Are you better off now?
I know anytime people mention money, I mean, and you say money wasn't a factor, people go, yeah, right. And let's be honest, yes, you looked at it to make sure you weren't going to be worse off as opposed to anything else. So once I was assured I wouldn't be worse off, it then became purely down to the job. Proportionally, even after the much higher taxation rate in the Republic compared to the North, and even after you allow for the exchange rate, I am at least 50 to 70% better off per month than if I had remained as a consultant in the NHS. So from a financial perspective, of course it's much nicer. Of course I get paid more. But they could actually pay me exactly the same as I was earning in the NHS and just make my job better. And I would have been happy.
50 to 70% better off.
Yeah.
That's some figure for Dr. Karen Humphreys there, who's obviously happy with the move for lots of reasons. I want to move on from health now, Una, to education. How different is that?
I think one of the major differences is that the education system in the north is often labelled as segregated and divisive. Some people feel that that's a really unfair label. So the issue where we have schools that are mainly Catholic and then mainly Protestant, that predates partition. After partition, there was an attempt to have children mixing in schools. The churches weren't happy with that, so that attempt failed. Things have mostly stayed the same since. In the 70s, there was a movement for integrated education, but now only around 8% of children in the north go to schools that are integrated in a purposeful and intentional way. And there is research evidence that shows that is a problem in a post-conflict society, that it can foster negative attitudes about the other. So in one episode, it's exploring why the growth of integrated education has maybe been relatively slow. There is also this program called shared education. It can mean a few different things, but in this instance, it means children can get together and work on classes and projects together. That would be maybe two schools, one mainly Catholic, one mainly Protestant, that are very close together. So I went to one of these pairings of schools in Belfast. They are a 10-minute walk away, but they're completely different worlds. And when the idea about shared education was first mooted, the parents in those schools, most of them said they actually did not want to have any mixing of their children. And the shared education teacher, Sarah Lote, explains why that was.
Oh, it ranged. Some parents didn't want the children walking into that end of the town with their uniform, especially with their uniform on, in case something happened to them. They had this fear that someone would beat them up walking over with us. It could have been as simple as it was historical hatred or historical things that happened in their family, and they didn't want, they thought, no, I'm not mixing with someone from that side. It was more parents' issues than the children's issues. The children don't see it as they're different. They just see that they're not allowed to play with those children. It's really historical parental issues and what's happened in their childhood that's now shone onto their children. They just didn't want them mixing, and that was it.
Because the majority of parents didn't want their child to visit the other school, Sarah had to spend the programme money on busing children to a neutral venue and hiring independent facilitators.
Parents wouldn't have wanted a teacher from another religious faith teaching their child.
Yeah, that's how bad it was. Now, not all schools had this issue. When we went to conferences, certainly we were one of the few because of the area of Belfast that we were in. But yeah, no, the parents just didn't want their children being taught by different teachers that weren't of the faith of the school that their children went to.
Did that surprise you? I mean, this is what, 2018, 2019 we're talking?
No, really. It surprised me in the sense, before I taught in Belfast, if someone had said that to me, I'm from outside Newry, country school, went to town secondary school, that would have surprised me. But from teaching in Belfast, it doesn't surprise me. There still is very much, there is issues here. I think if you've grown up in this area, you've been through different, troubles and stuff like that, obviously, there is that historical feeling. The feelings are there.
So that was Sarah Lote there. The parents did eventually come around, but it's a useful insight, I suppose, into why it's important to move at a pace that communities can find acceptable.
Okay, so that's health and education. And you also looked at the issue of paramilitaries. Lots of people mightn't realise, it's still such an enduring issue and a fact of everyday life for some communities in the north, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a figure from the Department of Justice that says 45% of young people are still affected. So I was speaking to a young man who we'll call Danny. We're protecting his identity. He ended up in drug debt to his local paramilitaries, and he said all too often the only way out is death or prison. Now, he did get out, and you'll hear in the episode how he did that, but he gives a really clear account of what it can be like living in a community controlled by paramilitaries.
I would have got off the local drug dealers in my local community. Some are involved in paramilitaries, some are just by themselves but have a link to the paramilitaries. In my area, if you're not in the paramilitaries and you're selling these drugs, you have to pay the paramilitaries a certain amount of money to be able to sell these drugs. And if you're not paying them a certain amount of money, then you have to join their organisation. I was never involved in the organisation, but I was always involved in taking the drugs. So before I knew it, from the ages of 19 up till 21, I was then taking cocaine, and then I started taking cocaine every day. It racks up an expensive bill. You're getting it, and then you can't afford to pay the bill. Then you're getting more to try and sort the problem because it's just a quick fix. So before you know it, these boys will let you rack up bills and bills and bills. For me personally, I had some bills were paid, but I had friends who had bills and being bait by these paramilitaries and had to take shootings to the legs and stuff like that.
My goodness, that's Danny. Now, people, this is a podcast, but people can hear it live on RT Radio 1 as well.
Yes, so it goes out this evening on RT Radio 1 at 6:30, and then the podcast is available soon after that on the RT Radio app or wherever you'll find your podcast. There's an episode a week, every week for 6 weeks.
All right, every week for 6 weeks at 6:30 on RT Radio 1. Una Kelly, thank you very much for telling us about the new podcast, which is called Our Lives in the North. Back after this break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.